Now, Ian McGarvey says, how many patients go through the hospital? I'd say it's around 60,000. Staff are frustrated. I think there should be an initial assessment to allocate measures properly. TDs need to step up now to fight for our hospital. How many extra cars go on the road every day, week and month? The roads are getting busy. I know that's not an excuse, but that is what's happening, yeah, indeed, of course. But you match the infrastructure, of course, should match the demand, shouldn't they? Right, now, I'm joined in studio by Louise McCormick. Louise, thanks so much for joining us. How are you keeping?
Good, good.
It's good to have you in the programme. Good to have you in studio. Right, okay. Now, you would be a social media user.
Yeah,
is
for sure.
Is TikTok your preferred platform? Or
I actually use LinkedIn more than anything else.
Really? I don't TikTok. Get that. I don't see LinkedIn as social media. I've never got my head around it.
Yeah, I guess I don't post on it a lot, but like that's where I've gotten like a lot of my jobs. And
okay,
like that.
Cool.
Yeah,
right, yeah. Maybe that's what I need to do. I'll stay afterwards, give me some advice. Maybe I'm only messing. Right, okay, so whilst you were on TikTok, you started seeing a trend in the For You page and some of the videos that you have been delivered. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I guess like last year I started seeing a lot of like posts around ADHD and it was all very relatable stuff. And I thought, oh God, I guess this is like, it's very relatable. Everybody has that. But then I started seeing a lot of them and I started to think, well, this actually sounds a lot like me. And so I went to my GP and went through the process of getting diagnosed with ADHD. So thanks to TikTok, which is...
And of course, the For You page depends on how long you watch a video and how you interact with it. So obviously it was picking up on this, you know, piquing your interest.
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually interesting for me particularly because I'm doing a PhD in ethical AI. So the ethics around people getting diagnosed with ADHD is certainly an interesting one and something to think about for the future. But yeah, TikTok pioneered an algorithm, which it's the most addictive algorithm. So it works in real time by literally looking at like just the tiniest extra pause on a video. It can profile you and know exactly what to send you next to keep you on the platform. So yeah, it is
amazing. And if you compare it to Facebook, you know, you establish maybe 5,000 or whatever it is, the limit is 5,000 friends or what have you, and they don't change really. I mean, some will filter out, some will filter in, but basically you end up in this sort of echo chamber eventually and you see that a lot of the same information and it's personal information, that's fine, all that kind of... TikTok can change. You could stop being interested in something and instantly it's on right. You seem to be a little bit more interested in that. It's really quite remarkable, isn't it?
It's actually scary. It's out of anything that I'm studying, people are saying, oh, what about ChatGPT? What about anything like this? But actually, for me, the scariest things, they're called black box algorithms. They're algorithms where we don't know what happens in them. And a lot of times the companies don't know what happens in them. And it's scary. It's scary because you could literally group a bunch of people and say, here's all these people. Here's what they think. Let's make them think this and you can very easily change that.
I very much thought before we start talking about what we invited you for, I was very much, and I said it on this program going back well over a year now, wondering how AI will change our lives, right? And I thought it's going to be really significant. And there's no doubt it will have an impact. But as things have progressed and I've seen the different variations of it and the different issues with it, you know, be it the gawk from Elon Musk or what have you, or the others, they're being overly woke and them trying to counterbalance all that kind of stuff. I don't know. I'm starting to wonder, is it going to be quite as impactful as perhaps we once first thought?
I think it's already doing it. I think people have started talking about it now because they see these conversational AI products like ChatGPT, but actually we've been using AI. It's so heavily integrated into our lives in ways that most people don't even realize. Like there's a concept called, like say in the States, they use AI for their judiciary system. So they use AI to predict for like recidivism is basically a person's likelihood to reoffend. So they'll use AI to calculate how likely someone is to reoffend and use that to decide their sentence. And that's AI, and it's proven to be racist. It's proven to be extremely unethical. People aren't scared of Google, but Google is a private company which has the ability to show you what's important when you search for something. You search for something, Google decides what the reality you see is. And people haven't really thought about that. But when you search for something, that's one piece. But the new trend now is you're not even searching for something. You're just scrolling through your newsfeed and you're being fed. You know, the front page of the newspaper I used to work for, Media House, like the Irish Independent, Belfast Telegraph. The front page of the newspaper used to be the most important bit of news, but it's not the most important bit of news anymore. Now the front page of the newspaper is your For You page. Yeah. So it's terrifying because you don't even know what anyone else is seeing. Wow. You know,
and also too, particularly this is not necessarily AI relatable, particularly since Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter and what he calls it X now. There is a complete blurring of, like, he tries to frame it as if this is where the truth happens, right? But the lines between what is true and what's not true now are indistinguishable. Like, you can Twitter yesterday on April Fool's Day, right? It would be very, very difficult for you to figure out what was an actual April Fool's joke and what was being purported to be real or what actually was real.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I don't know if we're going to get a reset on that, but I'm finding that platform particularly unusable. Yeah, completely. What is ADHD in your mind as an adult? Right, and we'll talk about sort of how maybe a lot of your younger life makes a little bit more sense. But when you were looking at these TikTok videos, which we started talking about 10 minutes ago, like when you started recognizing things or traits or stuff in you, how would you describe that?
Yeah, so ADHD is a really difficult to understand because there's so many complicated parts of it. On one end, people with ADHD have the ability to hyper-focus, to like really sit down for hours and just completely dedicate themselves to something. And then in the other end of it, people say, okay, well, it's you're distracted, you can't focus. Mm. So it's ADHD is essentially a chemical difference in the brain. So it's just a completely different way of being. And it's estimated, I think, that 1 in 20 kids have ADHD. And it's estimated lower in adults, but the reality is, you know, it's probably much higher because underdiagnosed.
Exactly. We're not looking for it in adults as much as we are in children. So obviously that's going to be a disparity, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just a completely different way of your brain being set up, you know, and how that kind of impacts your life. Then there's so many symptoms. So positive symptoms are things like the ability to hyper-focus, be able to sit down and really dedicate. And, you know, some people can have a lot of success off the back of that because they get into something niche and they become very successful in that area. But then equally, if you don't find something that you're really interested in or you really struggle, it can become not focused, not able to study, not doing, you know, well in school, things like that can happen as well.
Yeah, and then of course you'd be selective on what you could and couldn't focus on. It would have to obviously attract you in, and for other things you'd be like, I can't focus on. So you can be the same, you can be on both ends of the spectrum in the same person then.
Yeah, in the same 5 minutes.
If you met on two different days or in 2 different minutes, okay.
Yeah.
Right. So I want to go back to your story, and then I want to go back to the reality of diagnosis and stuff. So did a lot of your being as a young person make a lot more sense once you were diagnosed? Like particularly, I'm thinking in primary school and into secondary school.
Yeah, so I guess part of the reason why I wasn't diagnosed, and I think it's the case for, because it's very, very underdiagnosed in girls and women because, you know, societal norms, people tend to mask their ADHD much, much more successfully because they kind of have to as girls or women. So for me, I actually really liked primary school, so I was able to very much focus. You know, the primary school teacher said to my parents, you know, wow, I've never seen a child sit there and focus on a book and focus on her work like I did because I was hyper-focusing all the time. So I got to really excel in primary school.
But were other things picked out about your behaviour in primary school that weren't quite as favourable?
Yeah, so I guess like I had very messy handwriting. I kind of struggled at, you know, some subjects I didn't like. So spelling, I struggled to sit down and do that. I just found myself, I wanted to be good at it. Mm. But I found myself unable to do it. Things like not planning stories properly, just excitedly rushing things, you know, just rushing. Yeah. But you know, that was okay. It was in secondary school really where there's a lot less structure. You're responsible for your own deadlines a lot more. And that's when I slowly started to kind of drop, you know.
Before we get to that, what's rejection sensitivity?
Rejection sensitivity is where, I guess it's kind of how it sounds, isn't it? It's being more sensitive to rejection. So like, for example, if you felt different in primary school, like I was bullied in primary school and I would have taken that probably harder than another kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or if you saw two mates playing and you felt you weren't invited, that would pain you more, perhaps.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so secondary school. So then how did you do at secondary school?
Yeah.
Academically, like?
Yeah, fine. I did a okay leaving cert enough to...
But coming up to exam time, could you structure your studying over the year?
No.
Right, that's a big no-no.
I mean, I would sit in classes and just not be able to focus. I'd be falling asleep. I'd be daydreaming. And then I'd be panicking when there was a test. My parents sent me to evening study every single day since first year.
But when you saw a line, you could put your head down. So say, for instance, there was a deadline for an exam. You could cram a lot in. Could you just on the brink of that?
Yes.
Was that what gave you your focus? And then you could...
Yeah.
So then how about working independently? And I'm thinking homework, because there's a big focus on homework right now. So you have the structure of the class system and that. How does... Did for you, because everyone's different, how did ADHD, do you think, affected your ability to study independently?
I just couldn't. And, you know, I was never trying to be like bold in school. I didn't want to be bold, but like I would literally sit there with my bag unopened and I'd be sitting in a... I was sent to go study in our school. We had an option to stay for 2 hours and do study. My parents paid for me to go there. I just wouldn't be able to. My bag would be here and I'd just be sitting there like, I can't do this. Mm. I remember borrowing like books from kids in other years than me that weren't even on my course and sitting there and reading them. And, you know, that's what I would do for the 2 hours.
I'm speaking to those around you now and I suppose reflecting, did anyone pick anything up at all during your primary, secondary school to say that maybe, you know, Louise, and we could get an assessment or...
I had one teacher who pulled me up because my grades were fairly good. Mm. And like, you know, I was getting kind of B's and C's and even some subjects I really liked, I was getting A's. But I had one teacher who pulled me to the ear head and she said, you know, you're getting C's in the subject now and it's not good enough. And brought me to the ear head and the ear head said, you know, what's the problem? And I said, I don't know. I feel like I'm doing okay. You know, I'm getting a C. And I knew I wasn't doing well. I knew there was a problem, but...
You knew what to say as well.
I knew what to say. And then, you know, the teacher ended up kind of looking like she was kind of nearly in the wrong for trying to help me, you know, because I was getting like C's and, you know, B's. I was like, oh, I'm doing okay, you know, but I
wasn't.
You're
protecting yourself as well too, you know.
Yeah.
So what about college life then? How did, because now we're into a completely different space because, you know, all the responsibility, you know, you have to learn how to make spaghetti bolognese and everything. But how did college life with undiagnosed ADHD treat you?
It's pretty much the same as secondary school. So it was some really, really good modules that I was really, really focused on that I got A's in and modules then that I scraped by. And it was the same. My undergrad and master's are both very practical. So it was lucky for me in that aspect that I could kind of, focus on those things.
Right. So you eventually did get an ADHD diagnosis. Is it a hard process or was it like, oh, yeah.
It's almost impossible in Ireland. Like first you have to nearly diagnose yourself, right? You nearly have to figure it out by yourself because people aren't picking it up, you know, as I say, especially not in girls and women, people aren't picking it up. So you have to nearly know yourself and then you can go to your GP. I have a very good GP here in Donegal and, you know, he has other patients with ADHD. So he knew a bit about it, but a lot of the time people don't.
But you literally have to go in and go, I think I might have ADHD. Can you signpost
me? If you've been diagnosed, like the thing about ADHD is that if you can function, like I obviously functioned, my ADHD drove me to do crazy things. I've traveled everywhere, done everything. I've done just crazy things that someone said to me recently, God, it looks like your ADHD really made you live a bit of an unreal life. And I'm like, yeah, in certain ways it has. But when you stop being able to function, when things start to struggle, and this happened
in... What does that look like?
In COVID, it's what happened for me anyways, because normally if I'm like needing more dopamine, I just... go do something that gives me that. And so I can just do that. But when the lockdown hit, the things that you do to keep yourself going, those things weren't there. So you end up, and this happened to a lot of people, but for me, you end up becoming depressed. Mm. People think you have anxiety or depression. And you're like, well, I guess, you know, and maybe people do have those things, but a lot of people who are diagnosed with anxiety and depression, it doesn't look like ADHD, but that's what it is.
So, I mean, obviously then there are people we are treating, you know, chemically even, for anxiety, depression, when really it's probably an undiagnosed, like if we had an ADHD diagnosis, it would make an awful lot more sense. But other than things making more sense now, right? So in other words, you know, your primary school life, your secondary school life, your college life, and the way you live your adult life, what advantage is there for you, Louise, in getting an ADHD diagnosis so late?
I would say it's life-changing to get a diagnosis.
How? Why?
So it's difficult for me to explain it, but your brain just works so fundamentally differently than other people. I did a course in the university that I'm studying in, It was like a, you know, program with other people who had ADHD. And just going through that program and understanding techniques of how to understand what's happening in your brain, because it's so completely different than what's happening in other people's brains. Understanding like how your senses are impacting you, understanding how to, I don't know, feel yourself and understand yourself.
I think it's about how your consciousness works. Your consciousness is a strange thing. And I think too, if you, sometimes it's hard. So say you suffer from anxiety or what have you. A lot of it is your voice, your inner voice or your consciousness or what have you. And then someone who doesn't have that, you can't explain it to them. Because whilst you're thinking the same thing over and over again and worrying or thinking and worrying or thinking, you know it doesn't make sense, but you can't stop yourself doing it. So it's for me, like, it's not what your brain's doing, it's your consciousness, or that's how it shows, right? I'd be fascinated to have your thinking mind for 5 minutes to understand. Does that make sense?
It does.
You know, so yeah. I want to know how you felt coming in here, or do you find yourself talking to people and able to fully engage in that conversation but think about other things at the same time? I can really do that.
That's an interesting one. The medication for ADHD, if people opt to take that, it's not something I don't know, for me personally, it's not something I'd want to do for my whole life, but the experience of the medication allows the person with ADHD to understand how somebody with ADHD doesn't think.
Yeah.
And like, because people with ADHD tend to find each other, a lot of my friends have it, and you know, we're all getting diagnosed in our 30s, and I've seen a few of them being like, wow, like, this is how other people's brains are. Like you're just listening. It's horrible to think that before this, I didn't understand the full process of listening, but you certainly can train yourself to focus and improve on those things, you know.
But you can be doing an everyday task that requires conversation but still continue to think about something else.
It's not even that you want to think about something else. It's that your brain needs doing it.
Yeah, for sure. And you get that with anxiety and stuff as well. But then, in terms of medication, right, you don't want to blunt yourself either, do you? Because to some extent, you know, chemically it switches certain things off. You know, not everyone's going to sort of, you know, struggle it can still function perfectly in everyday life, right? But it will turn off some of you, potentially, right?
It does.
So how do you, you know, especially considering that this ADHD has given you quite an exciting life, right? You're an adrenaline junkie. I don't know how you describe yourself. I don't know your background, but it sounds to me like you could be. So do you really want to switch some of that off?
It's a balance for me. It's about, like, I certainly don't want to, like, I like the kind of hyper side. I like to be excited about things and you know, I like that part of me now that I understand it more. But yeah, for me, I do like that. And to turn that off for the rest of my life, I definitely wouldn't enjoy that. No, not at all. But it's a balance, you know, it's a balance. It's just about learning and understanding.
Sometimes is it nice to sort of switch off so you can see the wood for the trees?
Yeah, for sure.
And then that gives you a little bit of, it gives you a little bit of satisfaction that if it ever becomes overwhelming, you can do something about it. But at this stage in my life, things are good. I can handle it, so on and so forth, right? Do you find yourself mixing better with people with ADHD than people without it?
Yeah, I would say my life is surrounded by neurodivergent people by accident. Just all my friends are pretty much people I met in first year in college. We've been friends for 15, 16, 17 years. Like, and like most of them are like neurodivergent. Yeah.
Do you think we're all neurodivergent to some extent? Now we are, I suppose, in the literal sense of it, but I just wonder, like, I wonder if I went through a diagnosis process, I think something would come up. I think something would flag it, you know, because I do a lot of these interviews about, you know, and then an awful lot made sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of that might work for me.
They say one in 20 people or something like that is neurodivergent in some way. Like, people are saying, like, It's a part of our evolution. You know, there's a really interesting study from a really interesting person who talks about this and has been writing and publishing papers since the 90s called Tom Hartman. And he talks about this hunter versus a farmer lifestyle and how these differences in our brains evolved with us. So like the human evolution period is millions of years, you know, even Homo sapiens, a couple hundred thousand years. So these evolutions were advantageous to societies. It was important to have somebody who could take risks, be super creative, think outside the box, hyper-focused. Like, those are really positive benefits to have a certain portion of those people in society. But now our society has become very rigid. Our school system was literally designed to produce people who could work in factories, right? Mm-hmm. And we're moving away from needing people to work in factories now, but our school system is still the same. So everybody's struggling in that school system, mm-hmm. but more so people who are neurodivergent because it just doesn't work
so
for that brain.
So what are you saying? Are we like ants that, you know, in our Rory's form, we were like ants where some ants have a role. So some are gatherers, some are builders, some are protectors. And there was more definition in us humans and now that's all been blurred a little bit. Is that kind of the space we're in?
Well, I mean, just generally, I think that humans all have a part to play in your brain, your approach, your personality. I think that just as a society, we've always had a nice blend of people.
But the school system should be able to identify people's areas of speciality, shouldn't it? Like I have these conversations with 15, 16 year olds, like, and they haven't a clue what they want to do with their life, right? Academically. But they're being forced into making that call by choosing subjects, do you know?
Yeah.
And there's some wiggle room and you can opt out and in and out and others. But I mean, like, how can it be beneficial to society to force people at that age to start saying, well, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Yeah.
And we should be sort of identifying that, or there should be a mechanism to sort of say, well, you know, and maybe use AI, say that, you know, our markers show that you would be very good in this area or that area. I know guidance teachers do some of that, but it's really basic, you know. And I can't even enjoy sometimes asking people of that age, what are they going to do? Because you just get this blank expression, because how the hell do they know?
I think we've been teaching people things that they should memorize. And that's like our entire school system is teaching people how to memorize things. And what we should be doing is teaching people how to approach things, how to problem solve, how to love themselves, how to grow, things like that. I think those are the kind of things we should be teaching. But the idea of teaching people like memory tests as our primary form of
it's one of the key downfalls to the use of Irish language, for an example.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, yeah.
And that's just in language, let alone when you start getting into maths. What do you want to do? I'm going to ask, what do you want to do when you grow up? What are you going to do with your AI PhD? Is it in efficacy?
Yeah, it's in ethics. So right now, it's a bit of the wild, wild west out there. Like I kind of mentioned, the different uses that AI has, it's significant. And so right now, the EU are working on this AI Act, which will be legislated probably this year.
And I worry about that. I worry that they don't understand it or its potential, and they're saying, right, we need to do something. I think it's really important to get that right. You know, there's a lot of things coming through that you have to get right. We don't want to rush to introduce it. We need people like you having an input into that.
Well, I'm actually funded through the EU. So the EU have funded a lot of people in this area. There's actually people working since probably the last 4 years heavily on looking at what it is exactly that would make an AI system ethical. And they've come up with kind of seven areas, including like impact on, you know, society, things like that, down to
but
fairness.
How does that work then when they're being weaponized, right? So you could argue now what we have is we have an AI system, and I know it goes beyond what I'm talking about here, but we've got an AI system, say, from Musk, which is it's anti-woke, really, effectively, right? It has bullying tools in it, jeering tools, right, trolling tools. And then we have, you know, Google, whatever they're trying to create, you know, obviously, but we've seen the problems with that. So whilst it can learn and it's self-learning, obviously we still influence it. So we've got rival sort of AIs that will have that would make the world look very different places, competing AIs. This is not like Betamax and VHS. They're going to live in the same space. It's going to be really interesting, stroke scary.
Yeah. It's not going to be a quick change. The AI Act will be something like GDPR for businesses. It'll come out with like kind of restrictions on how AI systems can be designed, how they can be trained, where the data can be collected from. Like right now, you know, the data can be very easily collected. You know, if you're on a call to a contact center, in some cases, when they say your call will be recorded for educational training purposes, in some cases, that training is AI training.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what the AI is doing is it's learning all our biases. It's learning all of our, flaws, and then people are working to actively try to fix some of those things. You know?
And if you just want to know how good it can be, it's just, and I would say it's in the widest scale of things, really basic. Just look at how the algorithm works on TikTok.
It's remarkable. For sure.
Do you still get the ADHD videos, or have you moved on?
I've tried to move on from them, but I do get them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. And do you, when you self-identify as ADHD, obviously you have to for the purpose of this interview, do you prefer the neurodiverse if you feel you need to tell people, or what way do you, does it matter?
What do you mean, sir?
Like, so if I said to you, if I said to you, oh, this, tell me something about you, and you wanted to talk about that, would you say, well, I'm neurodiverse, or would you say, I've got ADHD?
I would say I have ADHD, I guess. Yeah, okay. I'm not too familiar.
Just understand, yeah. I just like to learn the language as I go. Louise McCormack, thank you very much for joining us on that wide-ranging convo, I suppose you could say. Do you have a big presence on social media? Do you provide any info for people, or are you more a consumer at this point?
I have some followings on LinkedIn, maybe.
Right, check out Louise McCormack, see what she's got. All right, take care. We'll be back with more after these.
The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Our next guest on the programme is Professor John Nolan, who is Director of the Nutrition Research Centre, Ireland South East Technological University, based in Waterford. Good morning, Professor. How are you getting on? Good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Greg. Never better. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you.
No problem. And people will be able to hear from you in person. We'll tell them about that a little later on. But just more interested in your background. Well, most interested in your groundbreaking research. Talk to me about it. It's about nutrition and the benefit of our brain and eye health.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm a nutritional biochemist, Greg. So I for 25 years, I've been working with nutrition and humans. And my interest was always about human function, how well we can be, how healthy we can be. A particular interest in sports. So vision, when I started my PhD, I was very interested in visual functions, but I started working in an area called age-related macular degeneration, which is, as you may know, is the leading cause of blindness in the developed world. And essentially with age-related macular degeneration, people lose their central vision, because if you think of the eye as a camera, at the back of the eye, we have an area called the retina, which is like the film of the camera. The very center part of that is called the macula, that does most of the work of our vision. So essentially, it receives all the light from the front of the eye, and it transmits an electrical signal to the brain.
And we expect it to do an awful lot of work across an awful long time as well, too, without maybe consciously saying, what can we do to grease the cogs?
Well, it's a really important point, Greg, because, you know, you hit the nail on the head. We're living longer than we are supposed to. Aging is a wonderful success story, but it's only successful if we can retain our function. So I suppose our research identified that at this tissue, there are nutrients there, and these nutrients are called carotenoids. And carotenoids are basically plant-based pigments. So when you look at healthy foods, plant-based foods, and you look at the colors in those foods, there's these active micronutrients called carotenoids. There's 700 of them in nature. In a typical diet, there's about 50. But we identified that at the eye, there's only 3 of these carotenoids. And there's a carotenoid called lutein, zeaxanthin, and mesozeaxanthin. So basically, they come from plants, essentially. And when they are concentrated at the back of our eye, they're called macular pigment. And that's a pigment that's protective. It's like a sunscreen in the back of the eye. And what we know is as we get older, this pigment decreases in its concentration, so we have less of it. And we know that people who are high risk of developing age-related macular degeneration, we know that they have a deficiency in it. And what our science has shown is that when we provide these nutrients, lutein, zeaxanthin, and mesozeaxanthin, which we source from marigold flowers from Mexico, so we've created a formulation essentially. And we were funded by the European Research Council, the European government, to run major clinical trials called the CREST trials. And essentially, we identified that when we supplement patients with age-related macular degeneration with this nutritional supplement called MacuPrime, we can greatly increase the macular pigments, and we can enhance their visual functions. Mm. So in a disease where they normally lose their central vision, we've actually changed what happens. We give them better vision.
So you figured this out through your research, right? But the body already knows it, doesn't it? Because it knows how to, once it's consumed... I'm speaking in real layman's terms here, but you know what I'm saying. It knows where to send it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So you know, nature's already figured this out.
The body's very clever.
Yeah, that's the point.
The body's very clever. And imagine that we, from eating, for example, spinach or You know, the lovely colour you see in egg yolks, that the body is working to take those micronutrients and place them in a really tiny portion of our body that's so essential to how we live. And you're absolutely right. And these pigments are concentrated at the eye, you know, in higher amounts than anywhere else in the body. And the reason why they're good for us, they're like, I mentioned sunscreen, so they're an antioxidant. That's one thing. The other thing they do is they help us use the light that comes in, the visible lights that come in from the visible spectrum. We're able to use those lights, and there we can enhance vision. So our work has extended beyond even disease. Mm. We work now with athletes as they get ready for sporting performance at high level, so we can enhance normal visual function. So that's quite remarkable.
And is this something really we should be aware of throughout our lives, so that we ensure that we are naturally ingesting this stuff and the body's doing its work? Like, is it better to take it through supplements at a certain age, or what's the best case scenario there?
Great question. So, look, we must try and do it throughout our life. When we see the first food we receive actually from our mother, breast milk, is the colostrum is yellow because of these same nutrients. So nature wants us to have them straight away. I suppose it's comparable to saying we don't want to wait till we're sunburned before we put on our sunscreen. So we have to get in front of this. And that's what we're able to do with these targeted supplements. Of course, we promote healthy living, healthy lifestyle, all these plant-based foods. But one of the challenges we have now, Greg, is we're not getting enough from normal foods. We have this devolution of the good stuff that's in foods.
And what really worries me too, even, you know, beyond what we're talking now, is if you, and I'm no saint in this regard too, because I know how difficult parenting is, right? But if you go into a restaurant, and you look at the kids' menu, or you look at what our children are eating, it's all brown. You know what I mean? It is brown. And as I say, I'm not here saying that, you know, my kids have done. I know it's the reality, and sometimes we just choose the path of least resistance. But there was greens on my plate when I was younger. There was carrots. I was, you know, if I didn't eat them, I wasn't getting food the next time, right? But you look around now, and an awful lot of children's food is just brown.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And if there's no colour in it, it doesn't have the good stuff. And, you know, I'm glad you asked about when should we do it, because when we look at like optometry, for example, now optometrists are not just about spectacles, it's about health. And we need our eye doctors, our optometrists across the world to be proactive in this kind of preventative enhancing area. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, remarkably and almost by mistake, we discovered that what we were able to achieve in the eye for vision played itself into the brain and cognitive function. Because these same, if you think of the retina, it is the seeing part of the brain. So it's part of the central nervous system. So the discoveries we had in the eye led us into work into brain health. And what we did in that instance was we identified in a major study in Ireland called the TILDA study, the Irish Longitudinal Study on Aging, that if we were to take, say, 5,000 people, which we did, randomly selected from the population, and measure these carotenoid pigments, and then you measure their cognitive ability, so their memory, their attention, their reaction time, and so on. Those individuals in society with high carotenoid scores, which we can measure now in the skin and so on, have significantly better cognitive functions than individuals, and this is cross-sectional evidence. So that was really nice data. And then that led us on to actually work with patients with Alzheimer's disease, where we identified that they have this major deficiency. And we were able to fix that. We combined the carotenoid antioxidants with omega-3 fatty acids, because the brain is mostly fat, and the good fats in the brain is DHA, which we typically get from fish. Again, we're not consuming enough fish in our diet at all. So DHA is very important. So essentially combining the fish oil with the carotenoids, we were able to develop a different formula, which we achieved a patent for the co-management and management of neurodegenerative diseases, including Alzheimer's disease. So this is something that we're very, very proud of. And it's something that we hope, and we can see now, can be used successfully in the co-management of these terrible life-changing.
And I presume also too, if you took a cross-section of society, there would be variances on people's ability to get the goodness from food and put it into the right place as well. Some people, the body's going to be less efficient at that than others are, which is sort of an add-on to the lifetime diet. What's the cost like, though? Because this is sort of heading in that direction, if you know, if we're talking about, you know, the development of, we're talking about the development of I don't know if they're called medicines or supplements, you know, that would be, you know, beneficial to eye health or for brain health. I mean, is it only for the rich? Are they beyond the means most?
Unlike pharmaceutical treatments, which are typically only for the risk or those who have health insurance, preventative food, targeted food supplement intervention is affordable. I don't know the exact cost, but you're looking at less than a cup of coffee. I think it's, as they say in America, less than a dollar a day. One of the challenges we have in the food supplement industry, in my view, is to differentiate food supplements that have a scientific evidence base, so essentially have been tested and demonstrated to work. That's one piece. The second piece is the quality. And that's why with the MacuPrime and the Remind supplement for Alzheimer's disease, those companies which have a partnership with our university are committed to that type of quality, mm-hmm. where they embark on continued testing of the food supplement, where they make sure that it's supplement certified, so it's stable over its shelf life. About 70% of supplements in the high street or in the pharmacy don't have anything near their label claim. The regulation is really poor in this regard.
And also, too, it's almost like a shot, shooting something with a shotgun. Like, it's like a million things in the one tablet. And I don't know. I've tried it before and I never felt any better for it, because you just feel like you're reading it and goes, it's got this, that, then better for everything. You take it for a month and you go, well, what was that about? It made my pee yellow.
Yeah, and that's
I don't mean to be crude, soluble. But you know what I mean? That's just how it feels for me sometimes. I feel like...
Yeah, and you're right. They're water soluble, and what you can do is over flood your system with too many of the stuff that... I mean, we should revert back to normal diet if we can. The difference here is with carotenoids, we're not getting enough from our diet. And that's why at Our Science, we were very strict and careful not to flood the food supplement with everything. We targeted at specific tissues, mm-hmm. knowing the exact micronutrients are there. We concentrated those and we can provide those in a way that we can change. And we've measured this change. Yep. It takes about 6 months to change.
But the greatest challenge is actually people trusting it, not trusting it in a negative way, but to buy into it, right? Because so say you were on here talking about Botox and you could say, you know, I can put 4 pricks in your forehead and in 3 days this will have happened, right? You know, people go, yeah. Oh, okay, right, that's that. I'm not endorsing that, I'm just giving an example of an intervention that's quick. But you're trying to sell people we're talking here about something where people have to have a buy into it, don't they? Because they're not going to necessarily see something immediately, so they have to trust the science, trust the people, and the benefits will follow. Is the argument?
They will. Yeah, no, totally agree. You're changing tissue level, and we're depending on a functional change. But the good news is that is very measurable now, and it's very noticeable. It's measurable. There's, for the first time ever, there's a device actually now that's been used in pharmacies. It was developed by a professor from Utah, who I know quite well, mm-hmm. and it's called the Life Meter. And this device measures the carotenoid score. So at the very least, the patients who do buy into it will be able to detect their change with appropriate testing at this pharmacy. It's non-invasive. It's very quick to do. But also, I'll tell you, Greg, that, you know, we have thousands of patients now across the world that have been on this intervention. And once they go on it, they will never come off it because they do see the benefits. And there's so many people now listening to your station who are so well worried, understandably, about vision loss. Maybe they have a family history of age-related macular degeneration, and even more so with Alzheimer's disease. And by the way, I'm not saying this is like a silver bullet or a cure. It's not. It's none of that. This is a part of the co-management. It's sensible. It's biologically sensible. It's biologically plausible that if we enrich these particular safe target micronutrients, we're all going to do better.
All right. So Life Meter screening, you just heard the professor reference there, is taking place in HealthWise pharmacies in May from next month. So that's the Life Metering screening you talk of. MacuPrime Remind supplements, they're also available in your pharmacy. And a lot of people have a good relationship with the pharmacist. They can go in and have a conversation with them about the screening and also the availability of these supplements. But just generally, in terms of good eye health, you know, because I would be conscious of my eye health, but I would be, I can't get into it because I'll be sectioned if I start talking about it. It took me 6 years to go to an optician, but anyway, MacuPrime, right? Is that for general eye health or yes. to protect the back of the eye? And like, is it plausible that someone who were to take this supplement could avoid macular degeneration, or does it lessen chances, or what does the science say?
The whole point of it is preventative. The big major study was what we call a morphological study. We're looking at disease progression. So if you enrich these particular nutrients, you stop the rate at which the disease progresses. But for me, everything points to preventative. If you're a healthy person now who's well worried, maybe you have a family history of this condition, and you just want to have better vision, issues like driving at night, glare disabilities, all of these issues which we experience even as we move into our 30s, 40s and 50s, we've all experienced those, these photo stresses. We can get a win straight away. Mm. But the real win is the preventative win.
Okay. What happens when your stomach can't deal with vegetables, asks a listener.
Yeah, it's a lot of people have that issue. I mean, taking these supplements, they're tiny. It's one supplement. It's basically 22 times the concentration of the carotenoid that you'd get from a standard daily intake, even if you're super healthy eating spinach and kale and stuff. So, you know, I try to eat vegetables, but I take the supplement myself every day.
Do you have a view on what the best diet is, asks a listener, keto, vegan, etc., when it comes to health?
Yeah, I'm all for balanced, a bit of everything. I think if it comes from the ground, if it's available to us, mixing everything is important to me. I think going to extremes in any type of diet doesn't have longevity and doesn't give us the best health.
Take something from all different types of food. So if you exclude those food types, invariably you're going to be deficient in something. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I mean, that's the logical. I take MacuShield or MacuPro Advanced every day. Is that any help?
So that's an important point. The supplement we developed at Waterford is called MacuPrime. And it is important to distinguish that because, as I said, I can't comment on the effectiveness of supplements that haven't been used in clinical trials. So it's not MacuShield, it's MacuPrime that we've tested. And the other point, as I said, is I would tell your listeners to look out for supplements that have an evidence base, but also have a supplement certified stability program. Are those carotenoids, which are the good stuff in the supplement, there in the first place? And are they stable over time?
I mean, a lot of people spend a lot of money taking stuff over a long period of time. Yeah. I think we have the responsibility as consumers to ensure that what we're doing is worthwhile, not pointless at all. Can you take this if you're on blood thinners?
Yes, there's no contraindications at all. Nothing like these are the safest. We have no adverse effect contraindications even across populations now with over 10 years of pathology associated testing with it.
Right, okay. You're speaking in the Rosapenna Hotel. Have you been to the Rosapenna Hotel?
No, I've never been to Donegal. I'm looking forward to it.
No, you're going to have a lovely time. April 6th, it's speaking at the GP Clinical Society Spring Meeting at the Rosapenna. I presume that's the audience has already been established for that.
My understanding is it's general practitioners and ophthalmology as well, so that would be great.
All right. Hopefully they'll behave themselves. I'm sure they would. Good boys and girls up there. All right. Okay. Yeah. Listen, thanks very much, Professor John Nolan. It's been an interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. God bless you. And of course, you can take that for what it's worth and do your own research, dig in a little bit and see if that is something for you. The live meter screening is in your HealthWise pharmacies through May. MacuPrime and Remind supplements available in pharmacies as well. As I say, that might be life-changing for some or completely disregarded by others. I do not know. Right, we're going to take a break for the weather. We'll be back with some of your comments after these. Okie doke, let's have a look at that weather forecast for you. If I'm on the right ad break, I believe I am. And it's better up here than it is down south. Today, plenty of dry weather with a mix of cloud, bright spells and a few showers, hit and miss. Temperatures 10 to 12 degrees. Now, largely dry tonight, but outbreaks of rain and drizzle will spread from the south during the course of the night. Temperatures 5 to 8 degrees. And tomorrow, cloudy, rather wet dates expected with outbreaks of rain and drizzle. Highest temperatures generally ranging from 8 to 10 degrees in moderate to fresh northerly winds. Do you remember the April we had? I can only timeline it this way. It was when the lockdown happened. Do you remember that April? There was like 3 weeks, 3 weeks that pretty much ate outside every single day. It was fantastic. but it doesn't look like that's happening this April. Great conversation with Louise on ADHD. Would love to hear more from her on AI. Indeed, might get a separate conversation on that because I'm very, very interested in Louise's story and her experience of a diagnosis relatively late in life for ADHD, but also her work in AI sounds fascinating as well. AI is going to be mentioned quite a bit during the teachers' conference, which are ongoing today, of course. Any man identifying as a woman is always a man, says the listener, but that person believes they are a woman as well. You know, that's they have their belief. So they believe they are a transgender woman, and you believe that they'll always be a man. Great news about Simon Coveney going. Let's get Helen McEntee out next. She's not fit for purpose. I can see Helen McEntee being moved out of justice. I think she's done a lot of work on domestic violence and other issues, but I think there's quite a few would like to see her move to a different department. 2 years ago, I had to call an ambulance. We're out in the country and we're waiting for an ambulance, as ambulance drivers and men and women are not allowed to leave incoming patients unattended. This means that ambulances are delayed indeed. And that's something we've discussed many times over the years, teams being tied up. At one point late last year, there were eight ambulances in a queue to get into ED, which was really, I think, one of the critical points that triggered the GPs and consultants coming out as they did. How many of the older people the media scare off the road today? Are the older people not just as sharp as they used to be? I find older people to be excellent drivers. Maybe they don't go sometimes as quick as you might like, though they all drive differently. I don't know why older people might be scared off the road. Very competent, the older people I know, and I'd get a slap if I said that to them. I was listening to the Wee Donegal Mammy and the following guest regarding their experience with Letterkenny Hospital and the HSC in general. Just to say that having spent months in Letterkenny Hospital being treated for serious COVID, I can categorically say that the doctors and nurses in the COVID ward saved my life, so I am forever grateful. However, the system is broken from local practice all the way up. Not all of it is to do with the lack of resources, although that is a major issue. Some of the problem is down to time management from GP level up. There's a hospital in the Midlands that has similar resources and population as Letterkenny and has no trolley or admission issues. Hospital management should be taken there and trained in hospital management. There are issues. Well, you see, hospital management is fine, but if you want to get your consultants to work 7 days a week or to be on call 7 days a week and not to stick to 9 to 5, you know, that's the new consultant's contract. A hospital manager can't compel them to do that either. So, you know, the consultants themselves are going to have to be a bit more flexible with the time. We can't have a 5 day a week, 9 to 5 hospital either, I suppose. But anyway, the caller goes on to say hospital management should be taken and trained. There are issues with people attending the ED unnecessarily and they can't get a GP appointment. This is due to certain clinics closing phone lines once a quota of calls have been answered, and also by the mountain of paperwork GPs must complete after each patient. Surely administration could be approached better, and better systems from clinic to triage to admission could be examined. Perhaps a time management expert should be looking into it. Thank you for that very well thought out comment there. And that is where we have to leave it on the 9 till noon show. Time for one more, actually. My son, who has complex medical needs, was in the ED on Wednesday. He was taken in and he had to wait, but he was seen quickly. The lovely doctor kept coming back in, checking on him. I've had bad experiences in the ED, but everyone who goes into ED has a bad experience. I just want to highlight the good work the ED do. We're not saying that ED across the board is poor, but we do also have to give people an opportunity to talk of their experiences as well. And as I say, this is in support of the staff down there, not against them, just to be clear. That's where we have to leave it on the programme today. Thanks to Donna Marie Doherty, researched and produced, and also to Shannon Wilkins, working on the show as well. We'll be back with more tomorrow morning from 9.